Compass Media Networks. This is America's First News, This Weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
The work-from-home future is cloudy. I'm Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up this hour.
More companies are gearing up for a hybrid office post-pandemic, but a tech analyst says companies shouldn't bank on in-person returns.
How veterans of the Afghan war are reacting to President Biden's decision to withdraw the 3,500 remaining troops.
In music, playlists dedicated to vaccines, which might include songs like Big Shot from Billy Joel. Also, hear what TikTok users are creating.
And the staggering number of transfers taking place in men's college basketball at the conclusion of March Madness.
As it currently stands, athletes in five sports, men's and women's basketball included, you are required to sit out for a year after you transfer. But momentum has been building for the past year. It was actually supposed to happen last year during the pandemic to allow athletes in the five sports that currently have to sit out a year the ability to play immediately when they transfer.
Lane Higgins at the Wall Street Journal on why you shouldn't get attached to your favorite college hoopster. Well, after two decades of midnight watches and gut-twisting patrols down bomb-riddled roads, after all the deaths and bloodshed in lost years, there's one inescapable question among many of the 800,000 Americans who have served in Afghanistan since 2001. And the question is, was it worth it? Dave Phillips, military reporter at the New York Times, has been asking vets that question after President Biden announced the withdrawal of remaining troops. Dave, what are they feeling?
So I tried to talk to people all across the country who were really the Joes and the grunts who did the work on the ground. I tried to avoid at all costs anybody who might have been in charge at the time. And they're feeling a lot of different things, but I think that it can be summed up as both relief that we are finally getting out, but also relief without any joy or comfort, because it raises two uncomfortable things. The first is, what does that mean about our word and our trustworthiness, the vows that we made to the Afghan people? And also, what does that say about all the sacrifice, the blood, the lives, the years lost that went into this effort that we're now giving up on? And so I think they're happy it's no longer going on, but now they have to wrestle with the question, what was it all for?
Yeah. The word betrayal came up a couple of times in the story and for different reasons. Can you explain what was said on that front?
Well, I talked to one Army officer who had spent three different deployments in Afghanistan. Each time sitting down in meetings with village elders and trying to convince them, hey, look, you need to cast your lot with the Americans. We're here to help you. We're your trustworthy ally. You need us, and we need you to work with us. And I think he believed that, and he hoped that they would believe it. And now that we're pulling out, he has to realize that what he was telling them and thought was the truth was actually a lie.
Did the U.S. win this war? Was this a winnable type war? I mean, we accomplished missions.
Right. I mean, that was the thing that talking to veterans all across the country who served there in different years, in different capacities, that they all wrestled with. Because if you think about it, we had 800,000 people serve over there in 20 years. Good people who are well-trained, who had good equipment. And day-to-day, they, won almost every time. You know, they accomplished almost every mission, and yet, at large, they lost. And so that's one of the things that people are trying to come to grips with, is how did that happen? You know, how can we win over and over and over and still have everything fall into chaos? And I don't think, of all the people I talked to, anyone really had any idea.
We're speaking with Dave Phillips, military correspondent at the New York Times. His piece is called No Victory Dance. Veterans of Afghan War Feel Torn Over Pullout. You ask a question kind of in one of your paragraphs. How could the countless sacrifices and small victories leave Afghanistan with no better promise of peace than it had a generation ago?
Right. I mean, we're talking about trillions of dollars, and as I said before, hundreds of thousands of people who deployed there put themselves in danger. I think that's something that the men and women who did that work don't understand. And probably that's true of the American people as well. But I think it's even more perplexing when you had an up-close view of the ground there, when you met the people, when you worked, you know, for a year to try and bring progress to one valley or one village. And, you know, what you hear over and over when you talk to these people and ask them what they did, they'll describe it. And inevitably at the end, they'll say, but that area, it's not like that anymore. That's all Taliban now.
So I was going to say, you know, to that point, what happens now? Because the Taliban is going to fill that vacuum as we begin to assign troops elsewhere. Right. Yeah. I presume you know this better than I would.
Right. Well, certainly that's the worry, right? Especially for people who serve there and, you know, for them, this is not, this is real. We're talking about real people that they know, that they worked with, that are now in danger. I think none of them know. They are all worried, but they were also worried about the prospect of staying longer. Obviously, for years now, we've been stuck in that between those two bad options. Is it worse to get out or is it worse to stay? President Biden made a decision. I don't think that things are going to turn out great. And the question is, will they turn out better than they would have? At this point, I don't think we know.
Thanks, Dave. Dave Phillips, military reporter at the New York Times. Coming up next, the spike in so-called gray divorces. When you call a Dell Technologies advisor, you're talking to someone who isn't waiting for their turn to speak, but who actually wants to hear what you have to say. They're focused on you, ready to give advice on everything from laptops to the cloud, and offer tailored solutions powered by Intel vPro platform to keep your small business ready for what's next. Our advisors listen, so you know your small business needs have been heard. Call a Dell Technologies advisor today at 877-ASK-DELL. That's 877-ASK-DELL. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. At a time when divorce is becoming less common for millennials, so-called gray divorce is on the rise for baby boomers. According to the Pew Research Center, the divorce rate has roughly doubled since the 1990s for American adults ages 50 and older. Here with in-depth analysis and some advice is Jennifer Hargrave, founder of Hargrave Family Law, based in Dallas. Jennifer, what's with the trend?
I think it is new in terms of the number of people that we're seeing. I think there used to be this idea that, you know, if you stayed together, you made it until your children graduated from high school and graduated college, that, you know, you would then live the rest of your lives together. And we're seeing that there are a lot of people who are interested in, you know, putting an end to the relationship. It wasn't a good marriage while they were together. And now they're facing the fact that they really don't want to live with this person for another 20, wow, 30 years.
And so has the pandemic highlighted unhappiness over the past year?
You know, I think what the pandemic did was it cut out the noise, right? So there's a lot of distractions in a relationship that can keep you preoccupied on other things. So, for example, if you travel for work, you're gone a lot, and you can kind of ignore the fact that your life at home isn't awesome. But the pandemic caused all of that to shut down, and people were stuck, you know, looking at each other and saying, I really can't stand this person. I want to get out. So, yes, we have definitely seen an increase in divorce filings in my practice due to the pandemic.
Wow. How much of that also, I guess, could be tied to money woes that may have come up during the pandemic?
Sure. I mean, you know, financial issues are definitely a stressor on a relationship. So if you don't have good coping skills in your marriage, that can, you know, it can create fractures that will end the relationship. And so job losses, and just, you know, other things we were anticipating were going to be bad, like, you know, the market declining didn't happen.
Yeah.
And of course, real estate, you know, is at an all-time high right now. So there, you know, while there are some definite financial stressors due to job loss, we've also seen that alleviated due to other factors in the market. But yeah, I mean, certainly that kind of uncertainty, just, you know, any kind of stress on a relationship that isn't healthy to begin with can create a very difficult situation.
We're speaking with Jennifer Hargrave, family law attorney based in Dallas. She's also a founder of Hargrave Family Law. And we're talking about gray divorce, as it's called. These are folks getting divorced later in life. What's the advice for these folks?
You know, I mean, I think that if you know your relationship is at an end, I would certainly suggest and advise that you approach the ending of your relationship in a very careful way. We have a lot of couples who decide to do a collaborative divorce just because, you know, they've spent 25 plus years together. There are things about their partner that they want to honor and respect. They just don't want to be married to them anymore. And a collaborative divorce is a great way to approach that. It also allows us to, you know, get creative in terms of, you know, looking at different solutions for how are we going to solve the divorce. I always approach a divorce as a problem to be solved as opposed to a battle to be fought. Mm. So, you know, that's how we like to look at it and help our clients find really good solutions that are tailored to their unique circumstances.
So at this point, when you see couples in this position, it's beyond repair. It's not, hey, give it 6 months, try these techniques before you break up.
You know, that's a really good question. There are people come into the divorce exploration process at all kinds of different levels, right? So maybe somebody has been living in a horrible marriage for 10 years. I mean, let me tell you, the grave has been dug. That relationship is 6 feet under, right? Okay. There's not going to be any resurrecting that. But other people are feeling really frustrated and unsettled, and maybe this is a new feeling for them. Maybe this was a marriage that they thought was going fine, and they're surprised themselves.
Thanks, Jennifer. Jennifer Hargrave, founder of Hargrave Family Law. Coming up next, the trend of college basketball transfers.
Innovation, resilience, agility. It's how Michigan businesses work together and continue to build the future. Our expertise, talented workforce, and collaborative environment are making a difference now and shaping the future. Join us and make your mark where it matters. Visit michiganbusiness.org/radio to put your plans in motion. That's michiganbusiness.org/radio.
Men's college basketball weathered the cancellation of its marquee March Madness event in 2020 and a rocky pandemic season in 2021. Now this offseason will feature a new kind of turmoil, a huge wave of players who are rushing to change which team they play for. Here's this weekend's Jennifer Koshenka.
It was a college basketball season like one we've never seen before, and now it's an off-season like one we've never seen. There's a huge wave of players transferring, with more than 1,300 entering the transfer portal. Lane Higgins of the Wall Street Journal is here with the story. Lane, why the enormous number?
Well, it's kind of a perfect storm of several factors. First being that the NCAA granted all athletes in all sports an extra year of eligibility when the pandemic hit about, you know, 1 year ago. So when that happened, they said, we don't want athletes to be punished for having, you know, truncated or modified seasons. So if they choose to stay in college for an extra year, they can. And then on top of that, the NCAA is changing its transfer policy because as it currently stands, athletes in five sports, men's and women's basketball included, you are required to sit out for a year after you transfer. But momentum has been building for the past year. It was actually supposed to happen last year during the pandemic, but it got delayed because of all of the craziness of COVID. But momentum has been building to allow athletes in these five sports that currently have to sit out a year the ability to play immediately when they transfer. So it's making it easier than ever for athletes to move, and there's also less punishment for having to move. So that way, more athletes are saying, well, you know what? Let's go for it. I have a chance to play one more year of eligibility and find a school where maybe I could start more or, you know, be on a championship team, and kids are moving.
So do we think this is pretty much a one-off that it will be this large of a number?
There might be a little bit of a bubble that we see for the next few years because the extra year of eligibility affects every single player. So a freshman that, you know, potentially has four more years of college playing, like, might transfer 3 years from now and not necessarily this year. So I think we're going to see a little bit of a blip before it goes down again. But I think part of the reason why it's going to maybe be highest now is that some of the reasons for transferring or staying that extra year are particularly acute now in that, you know, if you are graduating and entering the job market, it's still not that great for, you know, recent college graduates. I think unemployment is around 10% for that age group. And additionally, if you had you know, your senior year totally upended by COVID, you might want to stay for an extra year and say, well, I want one more go round and actually have a, you know, some semblance of a normal college experience where I'm playing in a packed stadium. And I think, you know, the way that vaccine development is going and cases are trending, it's looking more and more likely that, you know, it may not be fully back to normal in the fall of 2021, but it's going to be a lot closer to it than how it was in the fall of 2020.
We're speaking with Lane Higgins of the Wall Street Journal. Lane, in very, very general terms, coaches have not really liked this whole transfer idea, but they know it's kind of a reality now. What have been some of the complaints or drawbacks to the transfer?
Well, it does create a bit of a challenge when it comes to roster management because it's, you know, coaches have operated under the current rules and they've figured out how to make it work for them. And when the rules change, that means that their operating procedures are going to change, which means that, you know, you kind of, A, have to recruit the players that are on your roster to stay, which you would hope that any good coach is doing anyway, because if a player chooses to play for your program, you want them to have a good experience with it. But then you might also be looking at some of your competitors or other programs to add players that are transferring instead of just looking at high schoolers or foreign players. So it is a bigger pool of prospects to be evaluating.
Is there a concern of kind of a tampering or a recruiting going on where a coach will go to another school or to another individual and somehow get to that player and say, we want you?
There is concern about that. However, there also are NCAA rules that prohibit that kind of behavior. And, you know, the way the transfer portal works, in theory, you shouldn't be able to go to an athlete before they put their name in the portal and say, hey, I want you to come to my school. But, you know, it's hard to police every single action of that and hope that, you know, if a coach doesn't want other coaches doing it to their players, that they won't engage in that behavior either.
That's this weekend's Jennifer Koshenka with Wall Street Journal sports reporter Lane Higgins. 30 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. With Mother's Day coming up, I wanted to remind you about paintyourlife.com. If you're looking for a truly meaningful gift, they did one for me that my wife loves. A professional hand-painted portrait of our kids, one of our favorite photos, that Paint Your Life turned into a real work of art. I chose a world-class artist and worked with them to make sure everything was just right. It takes 5 minutes to order, and in about 3 weeks, you'll have a gift she'll cherish forever. I love their stuff. At paintyourlife.com, there's no risk. If you don't love the final painting, your money's fully refunded, guaranteed. And right now, as a limited-time offer, get 20% off. That's right, 20% off your painting and free shipping. Just text the word DEAL to 64,000. That's D-E-A-L. To 64,000. Paint your life. Celebrate the moments that matter most. Text the word DEAL again to 64,000. Terms apply. Available at paintyourlife.com/terms. Again, text DEAL to 64,000. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koshenka coming up this half hour. How can companies be so sure that employees want to return to the office? Also, it appears most Americans fared fairly well financially during the coronavirus pandemic, plus how Revolutionary War actors have performed during COVID, and the wave of vaccine theme songs. We'll have that story in about 20 minutes. It's time now for a business update, and it's brought to you by the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. The businesses of the future are being built today, and Michigan is where they start. Learn more by searching Michigan Pure Opportunity. Well, companies are building huddle and conference rooms in office buildings under the assumption people will want to come into the office to use them. But tech analyst Rob Enderle says there is virtually no empirical data that this will be the case. So now what? Rob, how do you see this?
Well, a whole bunch of stuff. Blind is a social network similar to LinkedIn that focuses on people at work and advancing careers. And a lot of the folks, or at least a lot of the employees, are indicating that they're out of sync with what their management is planning on doing. And what triggered me writing this column was the fact that as analysts, we were hearing about a lot of companies that were rapidly converting their offices into kind of groups of huddle rooms and conference rooms with the idea that people were going to come back to work and just do conferences, but we were seeing nothing that indicated that the employees were going to be willing to drive into work to do a meeting. Mm. They were perfectly happy doing Zoom meetings at home, but didn't see much benefit. So Blind did this survey, and it was to point A lot of the companies were thinking, hey, we're going to get a lot of our employees back as soon as this pandemic's over. And an awful lot of employees were saying, yeah, we're not coming back to the office any ever.
Boy.
In fact, you know, we'd love work from home.
Yeah.
If I go back to the office, I'm going to work 9 to 5. That's it. No emails after work. None of the rest of that stuff. I don't really want to deal with the commute. And just a general belief that, hey, everything's working out really well for me now that I'm at home. I don't really want to fix that. So that's a problem because management and the employees seem to be at cross purposes with regard to what's going to happen once this pandemic, if this pandemic ever gets into control.
You think this approach differs by generation?
Yeah, well, some of the comments certainly indicated that way. The boomer managers versus millennial employees was brought up a few times in the commentary where the millennials were saying, you know, working from home is just fine with us, or used to being online, and the older generation was saying we want everybody, you know, back at work, back to what was the old normal. And I think the interesting thing is, at least with the companies I'm working with, that they've kind of come to the realization that a whole lot of people, including a whole lot of executives, will never be returning. They'll continue to work from home.
We're speaking with Rob Enderle, principal and founder of the Enderle Group. He's written a piece for computerworld.com called Blind Blog Survey Finds Companies and Employees Disagree on the Work From Home Future. What I thought was interesting here, too, and you live and breathe this, is that even the tech companies kind of differ on this and don't seem to have a uniform approach.
Yeah, that's true. It's the tech companies are also kind of all over the map. We've got some firms that are saying, you know what, this work at home thing was great. Productivity is up. You don't want to come back to work. You don't have to come back to work. Other firms are saying, yeah, we really want you back in the office as soon as possible. Some of it has to do with whether or not they have manufacturing capability, because manufacturing, at least right now, needs to be done in person. Though we do have robots that are coming that will allow people to manipulate those robots remotely, and then, you know, change shifts electronically, and the robot keeps working. And of course, eventually those robots will be AI driven, and you won't need the human puppet master behind the scenes.
What about these companies that offer perks like, you know, free lunches or free dinners and things along those lines? Is that tempting enough to get people to spend that commute time in the car?
It seems to, especially with some of the youngest employees. The folks that are just getting started in life kind of live off those free perks, the free lunches, and some companies offer, you know, free laundry and a lot of the rest of the stuff that's seen as very beneficial. And indications are that those people will go back to get that free stuff, those perks, and enjoy them. But it also seems to be kind of age-related. The younger the company, the younger the employees, the more likely they are to really value those perks and use them as a reason to go back to work. Older folks, probably because they're more settled, they've got more income, they don't need those perks to get through the day or week, appear to be less likely to take at least that class of perk to heart. But the perks do work for some folks.
Thanks, Rob. Rob Enderle, principal and founder of the Enderle Group. Coming up next, a snapshot of our finances 1 year after COVID. When it comes to car and home insurance, don't we deserve better? I know I do. I put my policy to the test and turned to Gabby. They literally stand for Get a Better Insurance. Getting better insurance with Gabby means a better price for the same insurance coverage. Who knew something like this existed? They're the one true comparison platform with real rates. They give you an apples-to-apples comparison of your current coverage with 40 of the top insurance providers like Progressive, Nationwide, and Travelers, and all in one place. Use your current insurance info to get started, and in just minutes, you'll be able to see quotes for the exact same coverage you currently have, and it's free to use. Gabby customers save $961 per year on average, and Gabby never sells your info, so no annoying spam or robocalls. Put your policy to the test like I did. Get a better insurance with Gabby. It's totally free, and there's no obligation. Go to Gabby.com/deal. That's GABI.com/deal. Gabby.com/deal. Glad you could spend part of your weekend with us. Despite historic job losses and financial insecurity, most Americans fared well during the coronavirus pandemic. Jessica Menton, personal finance reporter at USA Today, has a look at a new survey. Jess, take us through it.
Americans
did make smart choices with their money during the pandemic. And it was some data that Credit Karma gave to USA Today exclusively. And it took a look at how payment delinquencies fell, consumers paid down debt, and credit scores either stayed relatively flat or even rose among certain score bands. And that was really helped in part as trillions of dollars in stimulus aid from Congress and the Federal Reserve really helped prop up an economy that was gripped by a recession last year. And so really Americans are doing better financially than they might think. But of course, there are still pain points for millions of Americans out there that are still unemployed or have lost income and are waiting to go back to work as we're seeing more vaccines roll out and as the economy slowly begins to reopen. But there are some silver linings there in the past year.
Okay, so stimulus money helped. I wonder if almost subconsciously were we helped because we just weren't going out as much because, say, restaurants were closed. Therefore, that money stayed in our pockets.
It was a big thing that had to do with. So consumers were also prioritizing saving in an effort to really be more prepared for the next economic crisis, because usually experts would recommend having 3 to 6 months of expenses saved in case you ever were unexpectedly unemployed or there were other emergency expenses. But as you know, during the pandemic, there's been so many people who have been out of work for potentially even the past year because of especially these industries, when you're thinking about hospitality and travel, that have been really hit hard by the pandemic. And so because of this mindset, a lot of the financial experts that I've been speaking with were saying that basically looking at the data, I mean, Americans have saved an extra $2 trillion during the pandemic and put away a little close to 14% of their income based on this past February data from the government. And so really you can see that because, like you were saying, people aren't going out as much. They're not traveling. I know a lot of people are itching to get out there once if they're fully vaccinated and once they're able to travel more. But it looks like people are really prioritizing that saving and trying to also make sure that they're prepared, not just right now, but for the next time there is any sort of economic crisis, so they have more of a cushion to fall back on.
Yeah. We're speaking with Jessica Menton, personal finance reporter at USA Today. I wonder, too, for the folks who are of that age in which they got a close-up view of the recession, you know, 10 years ago or whatever, and now live through this, if they are going to become really tight-fisted with their money.
Yes, that is something that had come up with a number of experts that I had spoken with, especially when you're thinking about millennials who got hit hard when they had either just graduated or graduated from college a few years before that when the Great Recession hit. And now this is the second major economic crisis that they're going through. And so looking at the data from Credit Karma, they could see that the ones that were finding some pain points more so than others were millennials compared to even when you're looking at, say, Gen X, boomers, or Gen Z, just because they were Gen Z, they're a little bit younger, and they didn't go through those two economic crises. And so it's millennials where right now, especially because if they're in sort of the median age, they're in their 30s, the eldest ones are already about 40 years old now. And so maybe they've gotten past part of the either paying off student debt, but now they're growing their families and they have kids. It's not just they're in their early 20s and maybe they're single, but they may have more expenses that they're hurtling with right now compared to maybe some of these other groups is what a lot of the experts were saying. And so that is something, especially towards that group, when you're thinking about those two crises that had happened, it's really hitting them harder more so than those other demographics and generations.
Thanks, Jess. Jessica Menton, personal finance reporter at USA Today. Coming up next, how Revolutionary War reenactors handled lockdowns.
Innovation. Resilience. Agility. It's how Michigan businesses work together and continue to build the future. Our expertise, talented workforce, and collaborative environment are making a difference now and shaping the future. Join us and make your mark where it matters. Visit michiganbusiness.org/radio to put your plans in motion. That's michiganbusiness.org/radio.
Since the COVID pandemic forced Revolutionary War enthusiasts into a prolonged retreat, many are launching a range of counteroffensives to cope. Some take hikes in the woods dressed in their colonial clothes as well as masks, which can startle other hikers. Others have taught classes online on how to create period shirts, pants, hats, and shoes. insight from Cameron McWhirter, reporter at the Wall Street Journal. Cam, what are they up to?
Well, you know, if you're a Revolutionary War reenactor, you're sort of in your own niche anyways. But your whole purpose is to go to meet people and march around in your costume and have your musket with you. And you can't do any of that during the pandemic. So it's been driving them all crazy. So guys have been sneaking out in uniform to go hiking. They've been trying to socially distance, shoot their muskets. It's been very a difficult time for them.
They raise eyebrows, I guess, when they go for a hike dressed in their Revolutionary War attire and a mask.
Right. It sort of startled other hikers when you are in upstate New York and you see a bunch of guys in tri-corner hats marching down the path. Yeah.
Wow.
And they're, Revolutionary War reenactors are very quirky people, which I think makes them really interesting. But, you know, I interviewed one woman who has two cannons in her garage, you know, and she's been going crazy because she describes reenacting as a lifestyle, not a hobby. So
oh, wow.
She's got more clothes that are sort of revolutionary style clothes than regular clothes, she says. So
jeez.
They're pretty hardcore.
And her cannons, can they fire but not cannonballs? They just fire powder? Like, do they function?
I learned a whole lot of weird facts. But the answer is they could shoot cannonballs if you wanted.
Wow.
And I also learned that a musket, you know, Massachusetts has one of the more severe gun laws in our country, more strict, I should say.
Yeah.
You can own a musket. And you don't have to register it. So if there's any... you know, you could have an unregistered weapon that could shoot somebody. But
wow.
Yes. But and so there's guys. So one guy I interviewed has a ton of money. He was stuck in the pandemic. He would normally be a British officer marching around, and instead he is in his basement, which he turned into a workshop to learn how to fix muskets. So he has about a dozen of them now in the basement. And I don't know what he's going to do with them all. I think he loans them out to his soldiers, so
jeez.
To speak.
Right, that's great. How about the one guy who uses the like labeled popsicle sticks to create formations? That was fascinating.
Yeah, these guys are, you know, like I said, this is a hardcore. I don't even know if you can call it a hobby, and they suddenly can't do it. So they're reading these ancient military manuals about how to march around, and they need to learn all these formations, and that's the whole thing. It's like as one guy described to me, you know, the 18th century, everybody was right next to each other. That was the nature of it. Uh-huh. So when you're drilling and marching around, you're all right next to each other. When they're playing their fifes, which was sort of like a flute, that's spraying aerosol all over the place because you're right next to each other.
Oh,
so
yeah,
there were all kinds of, basically this was not, it's a hobby that was not conducive to the pandemic. So now that the pandemic, hopefully, is getting under control, they're all itching to get back out there.
Thanks, Cam. Cameron McWhirter, reporter at the Wall Street Journal. Coming up next, vaccine theme songs. When you call a Dell Technologies advisor, you're talking to someone who isn't waiting for their turn to speak, but who actually wants to hear what you have to say. They're focused on you, ready to give advice on everything from laptops to the cloud, and offer tailored solutions powered by Intel vPro platform to keep your small business ready for what's next. Our advisors listen, so you know your small business needs have been heard. Call a Dell Technologies advisor today at 877-ASK-DELL. That's 877-ASK-DELL. We'll finish with this. Have you heard this wave of vaccine theme songs? While new numbers are going viral, older ones that mention the word shot or have vax-evoking titles are experiencing a popularity boom, too. Spotify says its users have created more than 7,700 vaccine-related playlists this year. The streaming service company says it's seen an over fourfold increase in vaccine-related playlists in just the past 90 days. The Wall Street Journal says these playlists often include additions like Pat Benatar's Hit Me With Your Best Shot, Billy Joel's Big Shot, and The Cure by Lady Gaga. How about TikTok creations? University of Utah student Amanda Harris has the most popular song borrowed from Megan Thee Stallion.
Ayo, just got the vaccine, which means I got them anti.
Then there's Jolene by Dolly Parton, who made a donation to the Vanderbilt University Medical Center to help the creation of the Moderna vaccine. Jolene can be easily swapped with the word vaccine for a relevant sing-along. That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koschenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend.